These things I recall to mind, therefore have I hope. It is because of your compassions that we fail not. It is because of your mercies that we are not consumed. Our grace contract is renewed by you each morning, and great is thy faithfulness. Father, we thank you for these things, that every day of our lives you provide for us our every need, and these for both life and godliness. We pause now to commemorate this grace through giving. We do so in the name of our great High Priest and only Savior, namely Jesus Christ, who is Yahweh Sabaoth, the Lord of the armies. Amen. Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love Him. For He who spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, how shall He not with Him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And please open the mind of Christ this morning to Daniel 9. We'll review a little bit beginning at verse 24. Have an announcement to make before we begin. I want you to know that Mrs. Barbara Tomkes of St. Charles departed this life yesterday afternoon and is now presently face to face with the Lord. The Sympathy of Grace Doctrine Church is extended to her daughters Denise Probasco and Dawn Tomkes, to her son-in-law Michael Probasco, her grandson Everett Probasco, and her entire family. Memorial services are now pending. This information will be given to you as soon as it is known. Our sympathy again for the departure of Barbara Tomkes to be with the Lord. Daniel 9:24 through 27 is the key passage in the Bible with regard to interpreting prophecy. Daniel sets up the understanding that one would need to evaluate the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation, of course, correlates with Daniel. All other prophecies in Scripture must be viewed through the prism of Daniel and Revelation. And so we are noting this in our study of the New Covenant to Israel. For in this particular passage, we see that the church age is ignored by Gabriel as he answers Daniel's query. Daniel wanted to know what events would transpire following the 70-year captivity in Babylon as a result of the fifth cycle of discipline that was imposed by Nebuchadnezzar and the Chaldean army beginning in 586 B.C. There are a couple of diagrams that we've been looking at over the past couple of Bible classes, midweek classes, and some of you may have observed them on the Internet, but in case you haven't, we need to go through them very briefly, and then we'll reference them from time to time as we go through our studies today. The first that we note is a timeline for this particular passage. We will note as we begin this review that there's a 490-year period. You'll see this down here that is referenced in English translations as 70 weeks. In fact, the verse reads in verse 24, 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city. Gabriel, speaking to Daniel, indicates that the people are the Jews, and the holy city is obviously Jerusalem. And this is broken down in, first of all, two increments. There are three total. The first increment is 7 weeks, and we've established the fact that the Hebrew word is Shavuah, and that is translated groups of 7 years. And so if you have 7 groups of 7 years, that's 49 of them. And we will note as we review the translation that that is the period of time that it took between a decree given by Artaxerxes, that's Longimanus, that he would be number 4 in that dynasty, in 444, 445 B.C., up to the time of the completion of the restoration of the city. And then from that point to Palm Sunday is 62 groups of 7 years, or 434 years. The total time elapsed during this period of time from Artaxerxes' decree to Palm Sunday is 483 years. At that point, Gabriel's prophetic clock stops, as is prophesied here. The church age is ignored, And then the 70th year, known as Daniel's 70th year, commences. But that is yet future, for the church age is still underway. And so the Jews are still owed 7 more years in their dispensation. And so there's a dispensational time clock that is going on. There's a national time clock that is going on. There is a restoration time clock that is going on. And of course, the Romans are involved. And once the tribulation begins, then this last week, this last 7 years will commence. The termini for the church age is the rapture that sets up the tribulation. It begins shortly thereafter, and that will continue until the second advent. And then there's the kingdom solution out here. The new covenant has to do with the kingdom solution, but as the kingdom solution cannot commence unless there's someone to populate the land. And therefore, a redemption solution must be resolved first, and that is the dispensation of the incarnation. Now, to bring all of these timelines together, this chart hopefully will be helpful. There is a fifth cycle of discipline timeline. Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem down in 586 B.C. and started a fifth cycle of discipline for the Jews. And it continued for 70 years by prophecy to 516 B.C. It was called the Chaldean captivity. The next fifth cycle of discipline for the Jews would occur in A.D. 70. And this dispersion will go on until the second advent, and therefore this dispersion is presently going underway, and it is called the Jewish diaspora. How long it lasts is unknown. As far as the restoration of the nation is concerned, it was restored after the 70-year captivity. There was a decree given to rebuild the temple, and this restoration goes until A.D. 70. This is post-captivity restoration, and it went for 586 years. Now that they're in a diaspora, beginning at A.D. 70, they will not be restored again as a nation until the second advent. And the length of that will be the millennium of 1,000 years plus infinity in the new Jerusalem. And therefore, it is a never-ending proposition. And this, therefore, involves the new covenant. There is a dispensational timeline. The dispensation is noted by Gabriel as having 490 years to run. It's noted in this passage. And that demarcation point for the last 490 years is 445 B.C., and it runs to A.D. 30. That's circa A.D. 30. You have a 49-year increment for the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the wall, and then 434 years from that point to Palm Sunday. That's 483 years. That's 360-day years. That takes care of the bad addition here that you may perceive. I can't tell you what a monster of a mathematical problem it is to go back and convert dates out of B.C., bring them into A.D., convert from 365 and a quarter day years to 360-day years, take care of all of the problems with the calendars that emerged back in those days, and to come up with some lucid number. I'll leave that to you to decide. All of this has been worked out by a man named Sir Robert Anderson in a book called The Coming Prince. And if you're interested in the numbers and the math, you can get the book. But I understand it's very dry reading. At the 483-year mark, you have the parenthetical dispensation of the church that runs from Pentecost to the rapture. Its length is unknown. Then, again, the dispensational time clock will resume at the rapture of the church and will run from the rapture to the second advent, and there's the missing 7 years. Those 7 years are play out on a 360-day per year calendar. And also, there's a Roman timeline. The Romans took over as a Gentile client nation in A.D. 70, and their dominance, the empire, lasted until 476 A.D. That was Senatus Populusque Romanus, 406 years from the fall of Jerusalem. And, of course, they went out in 476, and client nations have meandered through Europe and then across the Atlantic to us over the subsequent period of time, down to 2004. Rome will come to power again as the revived Roman Empire in the tribulation, and that will run from the rapture to the second advent. Again, that 7-year period of 360-day years. And at the second advent, all of that will come to an end in the millennial kingdom, the kingdom solution, the new covenant to Israel, as well as the other three covenants will come into play. That is what we're noting is the developments of the covenants to Israel and how they all will play out in time, both present, past, and future history. And also to note how all of this requires a redemption solution so that in the end there can be a kingdom solution to the problems that emerged in Eden when man fell. There was the loss of the kingdom, and there was the loss of one's trichotomy. There was loss of salvation, and therefore the creation of man fell, as well as the creation of the earth fell. And so this has to be restored. Redemption solution first, kingdom solution second. It was all brought about for the Jews through the Abrahamic, Palestinian, Davidic, and new covenants to Israel. So now let's go through the verses with that brief synopsis of what we're going to note. Beginning at verse 24, 70 weeks or 490 years are determined for your people and for your holy city. Now he's going to tell us where the 490 years begins in the next verse. I'll briefly tell you the remainder of the verse has to do with the following: to finish the transgression, to make an end to sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. All of those things are events that will take place at the second advent. Daniel 9:25. Know therefore and understand. Gabriel is addressing Daniel, and the first thing he says to him is, concentrate on what I am about to communicate to you. You have asked a question. The Lord has sent me here to answer it for you, but you must concentrate on what I am about to tell you. Know therefore and understand. The word for understand is sakal. It has to do with perception. Concentrate on what I am saying to you. Perceive what I have communicated. Retain it in your cardia. That from the going forth of the command. Therefore, Gabriel references a command that is going to come down from someone in the future to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem. That commandment to restore and build Jerusalem will start Israel's dispensational time clock ticking. And so you can imagine a clock that is stopped. It's on hold. And a certain event, some historical event, is going to cause that time clock to begin ticking forward. And when it does, it will be ticking down on a 490-year period of time that will play out in three increments. And he is going to delineate these three increments in these four verses. So we have a command, and we'll note it in a moment. It is found in Nehemiah 2, verses 7 through 8. Now, this prophecy that comes to Daniel is around 520 B.C., circa 520. And the command is not going to come for about another 70 or 80 years. Nevertheless, Daniel has the information and passes it down in his prophecy here. Therefore, his Jewish friends are going to know after his death what to look for in order to identify the moment when this time clock begins. And when the time clock begins, they have a good idea of when to expect Messiah. Telling you, if somebody gives you a prophecy that tells you Messiah will arrive in 483 years, after a certain historical event occurs, you ought to be on the lookout for that historical event. And you should pass that information down to your children so that they could be ready for it when it occurs. So we have here the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince. There shall be two increments of time. There shall be 7 weeks of years, meaning 49 years, and a second increment, 62 weeks of years, or 434 years. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. The troublesome times has to do with satanic attacks upon those who rebuild Jerusalem. Lucifer did not want Israel to come back into power as a client nation. He did not desire them in any way to have any more resumption of their spiritual life. Although the temple had been rebuilt, he tried to stop that, and now he wants to stop their ultimate return to the city. They are the ones for whom the unconditional covenants are given. He wants to stop that at all cost, for if their covenants are fulfilled, that means he loses the angelic conflict. So the command refers to a decree issued by Artaxerxes Longimanus. This was given to Nehemiah in Nehemiah 2, verses 7 and 8. Now, the date has been established by archaeological evidence as well as biblical evidence of Nisan 5 in the period of March-April of 444 or 445 B.C. Here is what the passage sounds like in Nehemiah 2, verse 7. "Furthermore, I, Nehemiah, said to the king," that's Artaxerxes, "if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me for the governors of the region beyond the river Euphrates, that they must permit me to pass through till I come to Judah." Verse 8. "And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest in Lebanon, that he must give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel," which pertains to the temple, "for the city wall, and for the house that I will occupy." And the king granted them to me, these letters. So therefore, the letters contain a decree to permit Nehemiah to go to Judah and to Lebanon and to rebuild the city. And this was the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. So let's go now to Daniel 9:26. This is where we left off in our study on Thursday evening. And here is an expanded translation of that passage. After 62 weeks, there are two time increments, you will recall. And after 62 weeks, there is going to be something that goes on. So let's note that time increment right here. This is the 62-week time increment. After the 434-year period, that's between the completion of Jerusalem and the public appearance of Messiah, that would be the dispensation of Israel, Messiah shall be cut off. That's his crucifixion, but not for himself, indicating it would be a substitutionary sacrifice. That takes place in the dispensation of the incarnation. And the people, that's the Romans under Titus in AD 70, that occurs in the church age. The people of the prince who is to come, we will document that the prince who is to come is the beast dictator of the revived Roman Empire, and that signifies the dispensation of the tribulation. So you'll note four dispensations are mentioned in this verse. He doesn't mention the church age specifically, but only an event that we know retrospectively occurs in the church age, and that is the Romans' siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. "And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary," that's Jerusalem and the temple, "and the end of it, national Israel, shall be like a flood." The end of national Israel. There is a national timeline or a restoration as a nation. Restored in 516, they went to AD 70. As a nation, they go out. Fifth cycle of discipline occurred at the same time. There's a dispensational timeline, though, that came to a temporary halt in circa AD 30. So don't get confused about the two. AD 30 temporarily stops the dispensation. The nation goes to AD 70. Fifth cycle of discipline begins there. The nation stops there. This fifth cycle continues all the way to the second advent. So these kinds of things, these timelines, must be kept in mind so that you do not become confused about certain issues here. "Therefore, the end of it, national Israel, shall be like a flood." That was the siege of Jerusalem by Titus and the Roman army. "Furthermore, to the end of the dispensation," that means the tribulation, "wars and desolations are determined," which means that wars and desolations are part of the divine decrees, "from now until the second advent of Christ." There will always be wars, even rumors of wars until Christ returns. Therefore, all client nations especially should be very aware of the need for a strong national defense. The Jews understood this. They failed on occasion to have a strong defense, and when they were in these periods of their own history, it showed, because that is a sign that you have lost your thought. When you have a poor national defense structure, it means that as a people you have lost your thought. The thought has to center on the invisible war, on the fact that client nations always are a target for Lucifer and his demons. He is going to bring in demon influence and even demon possession if necessary to filter into the psyche of the people those concepts that would lead toward progressive ideas. Progressivism views the fact that we're getting better and better and better as individuals. It is the result of evolutionary thought. Evolution says we started out as a tadpole and now we've made it to Homo sapiens, and God only knows how much better we'll be 1,000 years from now, but we'll be far more brilliant than we are. Therefore, what is the rationale that comes from that? You don't need to pay attention to the experiences of our ancestors in history. History means nothing because they were far more stupid than we are. Being as brilliant and advanced as we are now, we don't need to look back to history. We're just smart enough to figure it out, and therefore we can look toward the future as being a far brighter day. And if people would just only pay attention to us, then we can make it better for all of us. Just pay attention to my brilliance, and you will see. You may not understand it now, but it will be a bright new day in the future if you'll just go along with this idea of mine. So the ideologies pop up, and these ideologies are always fanciful. They always have to do with peace and prosperity, and the petunias grow everywhere. We are getting worser and worser and worser. We were created perfect, and we have degenerated since the fall. There is the need for a redemption solution. Man rejects it, usually wholesale. There are a few who buy in, and then they restore the dignity of man by acquiring divine thought, thus elevating themselves above the mundane chatter of the class, the wider classes, the hoi polloi, the canaille, etc. These are the ones who run the show and assume themselves to be brilliant. Those who believe themselves wise, therefore, are shown to be ignorant. And those who simply are humble and say, well, I don't think so. I believe there's a God in heaven. He runs the show, and you ought to line up with his directives. These are the ones that are accused of being southern redneck, red state type buffoons. So there's where we are. And in order to move forward, we may not permit ourselves to become progressives. We must always be traditionalists. Traditionalism means you go back to tradition. And what is the tradition of a client nation? It has to do with the experiences of our forefathers. My father was born in 1916. That's in the middle of World War I. He did that. He got through the Depression. He got through World War II. He got through the Korean conflict, as it was called. He got through what was known as the Vietnam War. Now there have been two Gulf Wars. There have been all kinds of historical ebbs and flows over his 88 years. And he has clear memories of all this. My dad is as sharp as a tack. He can't see because of macular degeneration, but his mind is sharp as a tack. And he can remember back specifically on so many of the events that have occurred since his birth in 1916. And what he remembers is how this country was built, really. If you go back to 1916, there were not many people who had telephones. There were no interstate highways. We live 40 miles from the capital city of Montgomery. If anyone then had a car and needed to go to Montgomery, they knew that it was an all-day project, that they had to get there and get their business done if they wanted to get back by dark, and they knew they would have at least two flats that had to be repaired on the way. And you took all of the equipment you needed to change flats, patching the tubes and all the rest. and you just didn't want to leave home unless it was an absolute necessity. I think nothing of driving down here, which is 20-some-odd miles. I don't even think of having a flat. Do you? And then all of the phenomenal things that have occurred since then, airline travel, space travel, all of the communications we have today. And we really think we're smart, and we truly are, because we have capitalized on the intelligence that's been brought before us, and so many of you are really geniuses in many of these areas. The point I'm trying to make is that through all of that, there are certain absolute principles that have not changed. Dr. Russell Kirk called them the permanent things. And through time, men experience things in the area of the crucible of human experience. There are things that emerge over time as those things that work, and we identify those things that do not. And the thing that has brought stability to societies over time are two concepts, actually. One is establishment viewpoint. Establishment viewpoint is found in Scripture, but man can learn these things by trying out various concepts and ideas. And as they do so, they learn what works and what doesn't. And eventually, these absolute principles emerge as absolutes. And societies define them as absolutes. And they say, if we're going to be prosperous, if we're going to be safe, if we're going to be people who can move forward, then these are the things that have to be carved into our legal code as absolutes, and we can't allow people to violate them wholesale with impunity. That's traditionalism. And the traditionalism that brings a society freedom is establishment viewpoint. That is the stability of a society. If the society is to prosper, it must have doctrinal viewpoint within the souls of those believers who are making the advance. So the few bring prosperity, those with a doctrinal viewpoint. Another smaller but larger group than the few, smaller than the majority, have establishment viewpoint. And they're the ones who impose these concepts on the society by law. Think of this for a moment. If the entire electorate of the United States of America was centered in this room, who do you think would be president of the United States? Not by an individual, but by definition. What kind of laws would we have in place? Who would be on the Supreme Court? What would be the laws that regulated our daily affairs in local government? What kind of restrictions would we not have on the freedoms that we were given by our Constitution? Give some thought to who would have positions of authority, what kinds of laws would no longer be in effect, which ones would be in effect, who would be the individuals who would define this. You would, and I would submit to you, that the guidance that brings these individuals and these laws into place would be divine viewpoint. That's not the case, nor do we desire it to be. Our duty is to serve God, to move forward toward our spiritual objective. We have the power of the vote, but the most important power that we possess is the power of prayer, the power to grow in grace through the grace apparatus for perception, and the objective of getting to spiritual maturity, at which point Jesus Christ controls history, not on behalf of the pivot alone, but on all those that we bless by association, which would be the entire country. So there's a lot to be learned from this concept. And the Jews play a big part in that, because the Jews are a direct target of Lucifer, for if they're not around to receive the imputation of the four covenants that have been promised to them, Lucifer has a leg up in the invisible war. Now, the incarnation of Christ as a dispensation, I pointed out the other day, and you can see it here, runs superjacent with the final years of the dispensation of Israel. The church is intercalated into the middle of the verse. The tribulation is referenced by the prince who is to come. He is the Antichrist of the tribulation. And the citizenship of the prince who is to come is revealed by learning who the people are that will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And the fulfillment of this portion of Daniel's prophecy is the siege of Jerusalem that occurred from AD 67 to 70. and we need to introduce the causes of this siege. And we go to the Encyclopedia Britannica's Micropedia under the entry Zealots. Now pay close attention to this and some things we're going to note subsequently, because you're going to get a lesson today on the fact that terrorism is nothing new. It has always been around. And it's not specific to one breed of cat. Okay, the Zealots. A Jewish sect that noted for its uncompromising opposition to pagan Rome and the polytheism it professed. Why were they zealots? They were zealous against Rome's heathenism and their pantheon. They were idol worshipers, and they were vehemently opposed to this. The Zealots were an aggressive political party whose concern for the national and religious life of the Jewish people led them to despise even Jews who sought peace and conciliation with the Roman authorities. They were opposed to their own people if the people wanted in some way to compromise with Rome. Extremists among the Zealots turned to terrorism and assassination and became known as the Sicarii. They frequented public places with hidden daggers to strike down persons friendly to Rome. In the first revolt against Rome, AD 66 to 70, the Zealots played a leading role, and at Masada in 73, they committed suicide rather than surrender the fortress. Now, an historical account of the Roman campaign against Jerusalem is provided by Philip Schaff's Volume 1 of his History of the Christian Church, which is Apostolic Christianity. I quote beginning on page 393. Under the governors Felix, Festus, Albinus, and Florus, moral corruption and the dissolution of all social ties, but at the same time the oppressiveness of the Roman yoke, increased every year. After the accession of Felix, assassins called Sicarians. Sicarians comes from the Latin sica, which means a dagger, and the Greek Sicarios, which means assassin. So these guys didn't have AK-47s. They didn't have those then. But they had daggers, and they would hide them under their clothes, and they would go into public places. And if they knew a person there that did not agree with them politically, they would assassinate them individually or in groups, alone or in crowds. They were terrorists, and therefore they had a political agenda, and whoever opposed them was a target. And they were called the Sicarians. They were armed with daggers, and they endangered safety in city and country, and they roamed over Palestine. In the month of May, A.D. 66, an organized rebellion broke out against the Romans. The ferocious party of the Zealots, the Sicarians, had all the fire and energy which religious and patriotic fanaticism could inspire. Does this remind you of anybody presently? It doesn't matter what your DNA is, it's your mental attitude. You can be a terrorist if you decide to be a fanatic first. Then justified that the end is more important than any means you need to get there. They gained the ascendancy in the progress of the war, took forcible possession of the city and the temple, and introduced a reign of terror. Must have been some French DNA in that. They kept up the messianic expectations of the people and hailed every step towards destruction as a step towards deliverance. They hailed every step toward destruction as a step toward deliverance. The more blood, the more mayhem, the more destruction of people and property, government, you name it. Destruction is progress. The Romans recognized the Messiah as Vespasian and Titus. To defy Rome at that age without a single ally was to defy the world in arms. But religious fanaticism blinded the Jews against the inevitable failure of this mad and desperate revolt. The Emperor Nero sent his most famous general, Vespasian, with a large force to Palestine. Vespasian opened the campaign in the year 67 from the Syrian port of Ptolemais and against the stout resistance, overran Galilee with an army of 60,000 men. But events in Rome hindered him from completing the victory. Nero had offed himself. Vespasian, in the year 69, was universally proclaimed emperor and restored order and prosperity. Now, his son inherited the duty of taking Jerusalem. His name is Titus. He undertook the prosecution of the Jewish war and became the instrument in the hand of God for destroying the holy city and the temple. Instrument in the hand of God. What does that mean? The Jews are being taken out as a nation. They are already gone as a client nation. Their dispensation is over. They have a 40-year period of grace in order to see if they can reorient. They don't. And therefore, the fifth cycle comes down on them. They're taken out as a nation in AD 70, and this is the directive will of God against His own people because of their degeneracy. Remember, they had clear opportunity to believe in their Messiah, and they rejected Him. Now, he had an army of not less than 80,000 soldiers. He planted his camp on Mount Scopus and the adjoining Mount Olivet, in full view of the city and the temple. The valley of the Kidron divided the besiegers from the besieged. In April AD 70, immediately after the Passover, when Jerusalem was filled with strangers, the siege began. So you got to give Titus credit. He knew that they had a feast day coming up, that all these Jews would come in from all over and fill up the city. The more Jews he could gather into one spot, the more of them he could kill. The zealots rejected with sneering defiance the repeated proposals of Titus, and they struck down everyone who spoke of surrender. They made sorties down the valley of the Kidron and up the mountain, and inflicted great loss on the Romans. As the difficulties multiplied, their courage increased. The crucifixion of hundreds of prisoners, as many as 500 a day, only enraged them the more. Even the famine, which began to rage and sweep away thousands daily, and forced a woman to roast her own child, the cries of mothers and babes, the most pitiable scenes of misery around them, could not move the crazy fanatics. Again, I submit to you, there are present-day illustrations of this. At last, in July, the castle of Antonia was surprised and taken by night. This prepared the way for the destruction of the temple in which the tragedy culminated. The last and the bloodiest sacrifice at the altar of burnt offerings was the slaughter of thousands of Jews who had crowded around it. Titus intended at first to save that magnificent work of architecture as a trophy of victory. But the destruction was determined by a higher decree. His own soldiers, roused to madness by the stubborn resistance and greedy of the golden treasures, could not be restrained from the work of destruction. At first, the halls around the temple were set on fire. Then the firebrand was hurled through the golden gate. The legions vied with each other in feeding the flames. Soon, the whole structure was in a blaze and illuminated the skies. It was burned on the 10th of August, AD 70, the same day of the year on which, according to tradition, the first temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. The Romans planted their eagles on the shapeless ruins over against the eastern gate, offered their sacrifices to them, and proclaimed Titus imperator. Jerusalem was razed to the ground. Only three towers of the palace of Herod, together with a portion of the western wall, were left as monuments of the strength of the conquered city, once the center of the Jewish theocracy and the cradle of the Christian church. The number of the Jews slain during the siege included all those who had crowded it into the city from the country. It is stated by Josephus at the enormous and probably exaggerated figure of 1,100,000. 11,000 perished from starvation shortly after the close of the siege. 97,000 were carried captive and sold into slavery, or they were sent to mines, or sacrificed in the gladiatorial shows at Caesarea. Berytus, Antioch, and other cities. The strongest and the handsomest men were selected for the triumphal procession in Rome. Vespasian and Titus celebrated the dearly bought victory together. No expense was spared for the pageant. Crowned with laurel and clothed in purple garments, the two conquerors rode slowly in separate chariots amid the shouts of the people and the aristocracy. They were preceded by the soldiers in festive attire and 700 Jewish captives. The images of the gods and the sacred furniture of the temple, the table of showbread, the seven-armed candlestick, the trumpets which announced the year of Jubilee, the vessel of incense, and the rolls of the law were borne along in the procession and deposited in the newly built Temple of Peace, except the law and the purple veils of the holy place which Vespasian reserved for his palace. The Temple of Peace was afterward burned under Commodus, and it is not known what became of the sacred furniture. The thoughtful Christian, looking at the representation of the temple furniture borne by the captive Jews on the triumphal arch of Titus, still standing between the Colosseum and the Forum, is filled with awe at the fulfillment of divine prophecy. I have photos, and I'm going to show them to you, and then in the second session we'll go through them. But there is a triumphal arch in Rome between the Colosseum and the Forum called the Arch of Titus. This is it right here. And then you can see depicted here the triumphal procession. And we will zoom in and we'll show you certain aspects of it and define it. You obviously can see the 8-tiered menorah there. These are other images from the triumphal procession. We'll note those. I believe that goes this way. And then finally, there's some aspects. This is a Vespasian here. They're actually riding in a chariot. And there's certain aspects about this that we'll note. This is the triumphal procession that has been carved in stone, and you may look at it in Jerusalem, and it is documentary evidence of the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy. And we'll note these details and resume this analysis at about 5 till the hour.